From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. When you're sad, you got the blues. But for some people, it goes deeper than that.
I've always felt a little off. Like, I never really felt really happy or really comfortable in my skin.
A conversation you won't hear anywhere else. A Latina almost loses her life to depression. And then, a disease that hides in plain sight.
Elaine was the life of the party, a journalist who could splash life into a good story. She was also, as it turned out, an alcoholic whose drinking was so severe it corroded her liver.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA as we explore what it means to be blue. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Oftentimes, in Latino homes, you might hear this. Ay, no tiene nada. Solo es un ataque de nervios. Oh, she doesn't have anything. It's just nerves. When in fact, it could be a real mental health issue. Today, we'll hear intimate and revealing moments from people dealing with suicide, depression, and addiction. But before we hear those stories, and they're going to be intense, why are Latinos at a particularly high risk for feeling blue? We reached out to two experts to give us an overview. Dr. Vincent Guillermo Ramos of NYU specializes in Latino adolescent and family health. And Dr. Manuel Guantes is the CEO of Turning Point in New Jersey, where he specializes in addiction issues. So just what are the main issues when it comes to Latinos and mental health? Here's Dr. Guillermo Ramos.
I would say there are a couple of things that stand out. One, that we're sort of oftentimes not identified. And so we often have our sort of health condition, our mental health condition, sort of conceptualized as being something else. And so we may, for example, go to a medical provider who may see it as a sort of medical issue as opposed to being a mental health issue. And so miss sort of diagnosis or not accessing treatment, which I think is really, really, for Latinos, that's particularly pronounced, that we are unlikely to actually seek sort of mental health services.
But why are Latinos unlikely to seek mental health services?
So I think there are a couple of things. One, historically, there have been problems with sort of access. The Affordable Care Act presumably helps with that, with helping roughly 6 million Latinos access healthcare services, including mental health and substance abuse treatment. It's also about having providers that are sort of culturally competent, that know how to deliver services to Latinos, that have linguistic abilities, that speak in Spanish and also English, and that can deliver services in ways that are acceptable. It means also dealing with stigma and sort of views in our community about what having a mental illness really means.
When you don't know what mental illness is and you lack access, misdiagnosis is easy. Here's Dr. Wandes.
They're more likely to see a physician or other general practitioner and sort of give a somatic complaint, like I feel really tired, or my stomach hurts, or I don't feel well, or I can't get out of bed, or I'm achy. And, you know, that might be more interpreted as a physical ailment and not really be understood to be a depression or anxiety.
Other problems like language barriers are not just about clarity, but because they might lead to situations where people aren't completely honest. Dr. Guantes again.
A woman who was interviewed who went to an assessment with her daughter, she presented as depressed, anxious, sort of PTSD type of symptoms, and her daughter was asked to be the interpreter. Well, she had been raped. And there was no way this mom could speak about that. So throughout the entire interview, that didn't come up at all until 3 months later when she saw a clinician who spoke Spanish on her own, and she was able to say that.
It's also about status and stigma. Latinos not feeling comfortable questioning their doctor.
depending on the level of acculturation of the person, you know, a Latino who comes here, who views a doctor as the professional and someone that if they tell you this is what your issue is, they won't ask any further questions. They won't seek a second opinion because they're really consulting an expert and you don't question an expert. Where I think phenomenologically, you know, a sort of Anglo person might go there to sort of discover what's happening with them, Google something, actually go there with information about the disease and ask the doctor questions, challenge the doctor a little bit, even not, you know, because they have other information, where a Latino might not do that ever.
But whether you're English-speaking, bilingual, U.S.-born, or an immigrant, there are commonalities between different Latino groups, and they concern Dr. Guillermo Ramos.
I think in general, I worry about the Latino community. I think that the Latino community overwhelmingly is clustered in sort of areas of disadvantage. And I think that in those communities, oftentimes what I experience riding the subway, visiting the community that I was born and raised, the Bronx, I see folks dealing with many psychosocial stressors, dealing with poverty, with sort of problems with, you know, accessing employment or being underemployed, sort of unstable housing or living conditions that create stressors. When we think about the cumulative impact of those stressors, it makes the Latino community more vulnerable.
Dr. Manuel Guantes is the CEO of Turning Point, a group that offers treatment for alcoholism and drug dependency. He joined us from his office in Paterson, New Jersey. And Dr. Vincent Guillermo Ramos is a professor at the NYU Silver School of Social Work. He joined us at our studio in Harlem. Getting help can make the difference between surviving or ending your own life. Blas Diaz works in a Chicago nursing home for the mentally ill, but he never thought he would find mental illness so close to home, right in his own family.
My aunt is 52 years old and has three kids. Her youngest is just starting college classes here in Chicago. I want to thank her for taking the time to talk about something that most people wouldn't. Here she is.
When I was first diagnosed, I was like late 30s, and they said I was manic depressant, and I didn't know what that meant. I thought I was just depressed all the time. But eventually I found out that it was called bipolar. And, well, they tried all kinds of medicines on me till maybe when I was in my mid-40s, they finally found something to keep me stable. But you have to play with medicines to find out what's going to work.
It can take a long time to find that perfect mix of medicines that leaves you feeling what we call normal. Nobody reacts exactly the same to a drug, and because these drugs affect one of the most complex organs in our bodies, our brains, many people with mental illness would rather not even receive treatment in the form of medication. So we've all seen those commercials for medicines used to treat depression, like Zoloft, Cymbalta, or Abilify, that talk about depression for 30 seconds and then list a ton of side effects that seem to go on forever.
Zoloft is not for everyone. People taking MAOIs or Pimazide shouldn't take Zoloft. Side effects may include dry mouth, insomnia, sexual side effects, diarrhea.
Tell your doctor about alcohol use, liver disease, and before you reduce or stop taking Cymbalta, dizziness or fainting may occur upon standard.
It's almost funny until you remember that so far, medications used to treat mental illness all have long lists of side effects. The truth is that you need to work closely with a doctor that you trust to minimize side effects, and this can only happen through trial and error and a lot of communication coming from both the patient and the doctor.
I was taking a Depakote, and that one would give me real bad migraines. I also had another side effect where I was confused. I wouldn't know where I was going. I would be driving the car in my neighborhood, and I didn't know where I was. So I would lose my mind. Another medication I took affected my kidneys. It would hurt really, really bad. And as soon as I stopped taking it, I felt a lot better.
If it almost seems like the medication is worse than the illness, imagine what it's like for children who are living with untreated mental illness.
I didn't know that I had my that I was bipolar when I was little, because everybody thought that I was just being spoiled and I would have these fits. And I never told anybody that I wanted to kill myself when I was a kid.
So you wanted to kill yourself when you were a kid too?
Oh yeah, I always thought about, you know, jumping off the house. I wanted just to go away. I didn't want to be around here anymore. I would do crazy things. I wouldn't remember a lot of things. People would tell me that when I was little, I used to fight a lot. And when that happens, I could tell that my blood starts rushing to my head. And then that's when I explode and I start fighting and throwing things. And like I said, I black out.
I knew her as the mother of my cousins that I grew up with. I knew her as my tía. She'd feed us all when my sister and I would go over to her house to play. She lived in the same neighborhood as us. She has a wonderful laugh.
Cool.
I asked her how she felt about getting help for the first time. I knew going into this interview that she had bipolar disorder, but I still wasn't ready for what she was about to tell me next.
I wasn't embarrassed. I wasn't worried. I was happy that somebody told me that there was a problem with me because I had kids then and I didn't want to kill myself. Well, I did try suicide one time when they were little, and then I went to them to say goodbye. And I looked at their face, and I couldn't do it. I took a lot of pills, so I started throwing up. I put my finger in my mouth, my throat, and I started throwing up. And from what I understand, I was asleep for 2 weeks. I guess that, you know, that medication did something to me, that I was sleeping for 2 weeks, but somebody took care of me. And I did it for my kids.
I've worked with a lot of people now who've attempted suicide, but I never thought that somebody so close to me could wrestle with the same issue. I thank God that her story has a happy ending, that she decided not to end her life and instead kept fighting. I remember thinking, if I'm just now finding out that somebody in my family has attempted suicide, how many other people out there are completely unaware that somebody in their own family is thinking of killing themselves?
When my family found out that I was in the hospital, they wanted to know why, and I told them. And they were very proud of me that I went for help and that I kept fighting every day to find my medications. But I feel so much better. My kids see the difference, and they enjoy being with me. In the past, they didn't. And now we're a lot closer. And they're happy now with me. I'm not the monster I used to be. I'm a person, a normal person. That's all I can say. It's there's no other word I can say.
For Latino USA en Vocalo, I'm Blas Diaz.
Blas Diaz's story came to us via the Vocalo Storytellers Workshop from Chicago Public Media. Coming up on Latino USA...
To me, it looked like she might be dying. That's what it looked like. I mean, her skin was already discolored. Her lips were gray and her eyes were really red. And her breathing was really, it was rough.
When mental health problems lead to physical illness and the question, should I have lived? Stay with us. No se vayan.
Hiciste que te olvidara y te olvide. Trataste que yo olvidara aquel amor. Existió, pero ya ves, ya lo olvidé. Se me olvidó que yo te amé. Frío me dejaste el corazón. Frío como culpable sin perdón. Frío como agua de un río que no le da el sol. Frío como aquel beso sin sentido.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Depression is something a lot of us, whether you're Latino or not, just don't talk about. But some studies suggest that Latinos are one of the highest risk groups for depression. The rate of Latina girls who attempt suicide is higher than other groups. And as we heard earlier in our show, Latinos have significant barriers to treatment. But these facts don't really tell the story of Latinos and depression. For somebody living with this disorder, the pain of getting through any given day isn't quantifiable, which brings us to the story of Dina.
I don't even know where to start because that is such a long story.
Dina is 39 years old. She lives in Texas with her husband, Jay, in a neat suburban subdivision. She has two kids, a 10-year-old boy and a 4-year-old girl. Now, the way we came upon the story of Dina and Jay, not their real names, by the way, is that I met Jay when I was stuck in an airport in Texas about 2 years ago. I struck up a conversation with him because he's a Latino who's in law enforcement. And then, as it can happen sometimes in airports, within a few minutes, we were talking about our families. And Jay revealed that his wife was in the hospital recuperating from a medical condition called Stevens-Johnson syndrome, which is caused by an extreme reaction to a medication that his wife had been taking. We stayed in touch, and then Jay told me that his wife had actually been battling depression her whole life. But I had never met Dina until just this year.
Mind if I sit down?
Let me give you a hug.
Okay, thank you. Good to see you again. Good to see you again.
Does anybody want water before we continue?
Even though we're indoors, when we meet at their home, Dina wears dark sunglasses during our interview.
I'm still at the stage where I like to keep them covered just because I'm not comfortable with the general appearance of them. And they look scary to me, so.
Dina's eyes were permanently damaged from Stevens-Johnson syndrome. She's now legally blind. She's not allowed to drive. And she can no longer cry. Her tear ducts were destroyed.
They do get watery, but the tears never fall.
The story of how this happened to Dina begins long ago, when she was just a child.
I've always felt a little off. Like, I never really felt really happy or really comfortable in my skin.
Early on, Dina realized she felt different from other children.
I just never felt good enough. Like, I never could find the good in me. I was always picking myself apart.
In high school, Dina had thoughts of suicide, but she never made any serious attempts.
You always learn that that's a sin, and you're going to go to hell if you kill yourself. And, like, the pain that it would leave behind, it would cure my pain, but it would just leave everybody else.
Dina went through all of this without any kind of help for years. No therapy, no meds, nothing.
My mom always told me that she just wanted to be careful because she didn't want me to have me labeled as emotionally disturbed or mentally ill. We just tried to do, like, a lot of praying.
Her husband, Jay, agrees. That just wasn't the way people did things in the South Texas Mexican-American communities they both grew up in.
You know, I don't know if it was because there was a stigma to mental illness. You know, I tend to think that that's what it is, that people think, well, you know, why are you being such a weak person?
So Dina gets through high school. She makes it, as she says, suffering from depression, feeling shame, not getting any help. And then she starts college. Around that same time, she meets Jay.
It was in October 1997.
They met online on AOL Instant Messenger and then started dating.
She was fun to talk to, fun to hang out with. And we seemed to have a few things in common. You know, our backgrounds were similar. And she was just generally just a very sweet person. And I really liked that about her.
She is sweet. And she has a real sense of humor that shines through even when she's talking about the most difficult topics. And as for the depressive periods, Jay was no stranger to that.
Well, actually, I had seen similar things at my house. between my mother and my father. I knew it was probably going to be a lifelong thing, early, like from the very beginning.
Jay and Dina got married. Soon after, they had their first kid, and Dina went through really bad postpartum depression. She did some group counseling at the hospital, but didn't stick with it. She had postpartum again after the birth of their second child. Then she miscarried her third child, and soon afterwards, things started to fall apart.
It was definitely not getting any better. It was getting worse, and she would even have times of like paranoia, and she would think people were out to get us, and people were listening in on us, you know, from somewhere.
On top of it, their marriage was beginning to unravel.
You know, something was revealed to me, and it just set me over the edge where I felt like I was ruining my marriage because of this. Like, it was causing him pain, and that he had to find comfort in other things.
I wasn't always attuned to her needs, you know. I wasn't the perfect husband for her. Probably I was, you know, a large reason why it didn't get better for her. I wasn't the man I should have been for her.
Around this time, Jay convinced Dina to try going on medication for her depression.
I remember the day. It was August 27, 2012. That's when I had my appointment.
Dina had briefly tried a med called Paxil before, but she didn't like the way it made her feel. She asked the psychiatrist for something else.
She's like, okay, well, there's this other drug that could be helpful.
The doctor prescribed her lamotrigine, which is also called Lamictal. It's designed as an epilepsy drug, but it has a secondary use to decrease the length of depressive periods in people with bipolar disorder.
She said, just keep an eye out, you know, if you get any kind of rash or anything.
A week went by. Dina started feeling weak and achy.
I just thought I was getting the flu or something. And the next morning, my eyes were very itchy. I thought I had pink eye.
A few days after that, she started getting a really bad sore throat. It didn't occur to Dina that this could be the rash the doctor had warned about.
Like, when I would swallow, I felt like bumps, like something was in there. And it turns out, like, I was breaking out, but I was breaking out from the inside.
And as the day progressed, it even started affecting her breathing. And then she started to get these red dots on her skin that seemed to multiply. They, like, started out as just a few, and then it just increased and eventually covered all her body.
Dina and Jay started to realize this was really serious, and they went to the emergency room. Hours later, the doctors finally figured out that Dina had developed Stevens-Johnson syndrome. It's a rare, life-threatening condition in which cell death causes the skin to blister, then separate from the body and die. It's like your epidermis just starts to peel off. The doctors called Jay back to the hospital immediately.
To me, it looked like she might be dying. That's what it looked like. I mean, her skin was already discolored. Her lips were gray, and her eyes were really red. And her breathing was really, it was rough.
It was really scary. And then I don't remember much after that.
Dina was airlifted by helicopter to a military hospital where they had the technology to treat her. She was in intensive care for over a month, in a medical coma for much of that time, under constant care. Stevens-Johnson continued to rip through her body.
There were patches of her skin that were peeling away as the days went on. So the same thing that was happening to her skin was happening onto the eyes, you know, and even inside her lungs, you know, that this... The upper layer of the body was dying away.
I seen some pictures of myself, and I was literally like one big scab. I mean, I look probably like I could be on The Walking Dead. I mean, I was, you know, it was like I was burned, like someone lit a match to me.
The doctors wrapped her in medical dressings like you would for a burn victim. To keep her alive, her blood had to be oxygenated outside of her body. And through the process, because her lungs were so scarred, she often had to rely on a ventilator to breathe.
Okay, what's all this?
The top one's broccoli and beef. And you want this one?
Eventually, Dina started to get better.
Chicken, and you can put some sweet and sour sauce in there if you want.
Doctors told her that her recovery was miraculous. She didn't end up needing any skin grafts, even though the disease affected 90% of her body. Her vision was damaged. She's now legally blind. She lost all of her fingernails. Scarring in her throat has affected her voice forever. And there's still some scarring and discoloration on her skin. But she survived.
I do feel lucky to be alive, and I do feel lucky to be walking around and not sitting in a wheelchair or attached to an oxygen machine.
She can't see, but she can more or less live her life as before. Still, she says,
it's hard. Just knowing that I'm different now, like I can never be what I was before. I have to kind of start from scratch.
One thing that's changed for Dina is the way she thinks about medical care.
Because I always viewed doctors as kind of like these superhuman people, like the smartest people. They always know what's good for you. And lately that has really changed.
Stevens-Johnson syndrome can potentially be caused by an allergic reaction to any medication. But studies have especially linked lamotrigine to it. Dina says she wasn't warned about the drug's real dangers. She says she doesn't blame the doctors or anyone else for what happened to her. But Jay does blame himself. He goes back to one moment in the hospital. Dina was unconscious, and Jay had to decide whether or not to put Dina on a ventilator. If he didn't, her brain and organs would almost certainly fail.
And to some people, it would seem completely obvious, oh, well, we have to put her on this machine. And that's the decision I made, but one point in our marriage, she told me that if she ever needed some type of machine to keep her alive, to not do it. And that came into my mind, you know. And I also remember hearing that if somebody's mentally ill and they say, I want to die, do they really mean that? There was doubt in my mind whether I was going to make the right decision or not. But, you know, I had to say yes. I had to say yes, let's do what we can to keep her alive, you know?
So Dina sometimes says to you still, you should have just let me die?
Yes, she does.
What is that like for you, Jay?
It's hurtful. All those days I was there, you know, hoping that she was going to make it through and be able to see the kids again. And I know that there's days when she feels like she really means what she says when she tells me, you should have let me die. But I tell myself that that's the mental illness talking. And so when she's having a really severe depression and she's yelling, sometimes I think to myself at that moment, was it the right decision? Is she going to spend the rest of her life suffering and blaming me? Did I make the right decision? You know, it's like, how do you know it was the right decision? You just don't. So, but on the good days, there's been good days since then, and, you know, there's been bad days since then, too. But on the good days, I reassure myself, it's like, that was the right decision to make.
Do you think that you, Jay, are now battling your own depression after what's happened with Dina?
Yeah, that's true. I do get depressed about it. There's no other word for it. And, you know, I feel guilty because I try to disconnect from it, you know, on a daily basis. I get up and I say, well, I have to go to work. So I try to make a disconnect. Yeah, but it's always there. You know, you never really disconnect completely.
At first, I really wished I was dead because I saw the struggle that was gonna. I saw what was coming. I'm almost ashamed to say it, but I almost felt gypped, like I wouldn't have to deal with life anymore.
Depression and mental illness for Latinos in particular, I think, is hard. Can you talk a little bit about the shame and the silence and what you think about it now?
I still have shame about it because I don't know why I can't just pull myself together. People make it sound like it's a choice, like you need to decide. Like, it's your choice to be happy. I mean, every day I try hard to think positive, and I still struggle. Like, it's like an angel on your shoulder and a devil on your shoulder. And you just all back and forth all day. It's, like, exhausting. I have to, like, look at my kids and remind myself why I'm here. And, like, I mean, they're the reason I live. I mean, that's what I am. I'm their mother. You know, I have to get better for them. I guess I do feel shame that I can't seem to just turn it around, you know. But I'm trying.
Thanks to Dina and Jay for sharing their story. They did it because they want to help others. But their ending isn't necessarily a good one. Often, as journalists, we try to wrap up our stories neatly, to bring you lessons and give you, our listeners, some kind of resolution. But of course, reality is rarely that simple. In the end, Dina and Jay are just a middle-class Mexican-American family from suburban Texas. They still struggle, like so many others, to raise two kids and handle their own marital and health problems. So when we asked what they've learned from this experience, their answers were practical. Be careful when taking a new medication. Question your doctors. Deal with your problems head on. They still live day by day, some days better than others, and they're still trying to get help. But they're not giving up. And maybe it's that will to keep trying, a will that doesn't always come easily, that sustains them. That and their hope to raise physically and mentally healthy kids. Now, if you're hearing this and you hear yourself reflected and you live in the United States, there is help out there. The National Suicide Prevention Helpline is 1-800-273-8255. We have links to more resources on our website, latinousa.org. Hay ayuda. Búscala si la necesitas. La línea nacional de esperanza es 1-800-SUICIDA. Coming up on Latino USA.
It was almost like you translated to, oh, come on, hang out with me a little longer. I never thought having another drink was hurting her.
How the ones we love secretly suffer, and then it ends. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Sometimes problems like depression, suicide, alcoholism, they just hit too close to home. Elaine Rivera was a powerful, brilliant journalist and a friend of mine. She was also an alcoholic, but I didn't know it. After Elaine's death last year from cirrhosis, our mutual friend and fellow journalist, Rose Arce, dug into the circumstances around her death. Now, Rose brings us Elaine's story about the cruel irony and lessons to be learned when a friend's disease spirals out of control.
When my friend Elaine Rivera died, it felt almost like the end of a fireworks show, when the smoke hangs in the air and crowds walk slowly home. The fun was over in a flash. Elaine was the life of the party, a girl who urged you to stay for just one more drink, a journalist who could splash life into a good story. She was also, as it turned out, an alcoholic whose drinking was so severe it corroded her liver until it just stopped working. Just a few weeks before her October 26th death from cirrhosis, she looked out the window of her condo in the Bronx at a stunning view of the crowds whooping it up at Yankee Stadium. "Here I am, just another Puerto Rican in the Bronx watching the Yankees. Every one of those people has a beer in their hand," she rambled on, noting how Puerto Ricans are big baseball fans. "What is it about Puerto Ricans and drinking?" That was the same day she said, "Rose, I don't think I'm going to make it." And then she didn't. Elaine, 54 when she died, was a well-educated Latina who had devoted her career to reporting on the neglect of poor ethnic communities. Now she'd ended her life like the anecdotal lead to one of her stories, this one on how Latinos are dying from alcoholism-related cirrhosis at higher rates than any other ethnic or racial groups, and no one seems to know precisely why. Elaine knew all about Puerto Ricans fighting off a culture of drinking. In the weeks before she was diagnosed, she'd raged about a dust-up between some Puerto Rican leaders and Coors. The beer company had apologized after some Puerto Ricans felt insulted by a Coors can emblazoned with the Puerto Rican flag. Coors later issued an apology, noting its sponsorship of scholarships for Latinos, and said it was trying to celebrate culture. It stopped production of the cans. Elaine had left full-time journalism to teach at Lehman College and was hoping her students would adopt her passion for covering racial and ethnic minorities. Even as she talked about the community's divisions, though, Elaine never fully acknowledged that she had a drinking problem. Elaine's family didn't see it coming until very late. "She had a little traguito, as they say, but I didn't think she was an addict," said her brother, Randy Rivera. Elaine came from a solid working-class family from Cleveland, a destination for Puerto Ricans searching for manufacturing jobs in years past. "Last Christmas," her brother said, "she came home looking white as a ghost. She looked swollen. She didn't eat well at dinner. The family always bought a bottle of liquor for guests, and when her brother woke up the next morning after her arrival, it was mysteriously empty." The year before, their sister Joyce had died from cirrhosis. Randy Rivera remembers trying to wrench a bottle of alcohol from Joyce's hands. "I told Joyce, the only way you'll stop is in the grave." And that turned out to be true. They recognized the physical signs in Elaine, but didn't connect it to heavy drinking. "With Elaine, we didn't know the severity of her drinking," said her older sister Maricel Rivera. "She'd be up late drinking when she visited, but we thought she was just stressed from work. Now I can't believe this disease has taken two of my sisters." The next time Elaine's family visited, she was in Mount Sinai Hospital, having fluid drained from her body because her liver was not filtering fluids adequately. Doctors describe cirrhosis as a particularly cruel disease because it's caused by scarring in the liver as it's trying to regenerate and maintain its function against the onslaught of abuse. It basically hurts itself trying to survive. Elaine was a journalist, a profession where much romanticized pub crawls are legendary. As I told her former colleagues of her death, many asked whether something else might have caused cirrhosis or how much drinking might make you sick. When I told them the autopsy firmly connected her death to long-term alcohol consumption, they seemed incredulous. Hers had been a slow, unintentional suicide, aided by the many drinks she shared with her reporter buddies in celebration of the last big story. In that other culture of hers, no one had seen it coming either. Elaine's friends and family gathered to celebrate her life and work and raise money for a scholarship fund for poor minority journalism students devoted to continuing her work. I found it also heart-crushing that I couldn't bring myself to join the memorial speech-making that day. There was just too much talk of the importance of her kind of reporting, but little, if anything, about why she died. I remembered her by telling the story of how her easy smile and zest for justice was snuffed out by an awful disease plaguing her own community. I just wish she was here to have written it herself.
How was it possible, Rose, that we are journalists, we report on these issues, Elaine was, you know, down and dirty journalist, we talked about everything, we criticized everything, we tore down, built up, and yet I was never aware that Elaine was an alcoholic.
I don't think anybody was. Everybody knew she drank. But I think we all assumed that she'd go out and sort of tie one on or whatever that phrase is with one of us. And then, like, the rest of us, she'd get up the next morning and say, oh, what was I thinking? And then that was it. But the problem was she'd do that with me on Monday and you on Tuesday and somebody else on Wednesday. I think that's what was going on. I also think she was depressed. Cirrhosis, it's kind of this sick little disease where the drinking is unrelenting and the liver's efforts to address it are also unrelenting. So the more you drink, the worse your liver gets, the more it gets scarred trying to repair itself, kind of steel itself for the onslaught, and that scarring is ultimately what makes it impossible for it to do its job.
Do you remember the first time that you talked with Elaine about the drinking in a way that was not just like, oh, you know, making fun of it?
Oh, you know, the first time was in the hospital. I don't think I'd ever had a conversation with her about drinking before that because she was not an alcoholic who blacked out, got nasty. She never crashed her car. She never did any of the things that where you'd say, wow, you know?
No DUIs.
Nope.
No major fights.
No DUIs. Yeah,
never ended
fight,
up in, but never ended up in the hospital.
No. She never wrote anybody off. There was never like that, you know, that personal toll that drinking can take, and not in any apparent way. You know,
it was like she was a happy drinker when we saw her.
Absolutely. When she drank, it was like, let's have another drink. But it felt like it was more about you. It was almost like you translated to, oh, come on, hang out with me a little longer. I never thought having another drink was hurting her.
Do we know how she ended up in the hospital to begin with?
She told us that she had stopped drinking and she thought she was getting sicker. She just went to the hospital because she was feeling increasingly ill and bloated. The day that we walked in, you would have thought she was having twins. I'd never seen anything like this. She had this related illness where essentially your body cannot process liquid, so it builds them up, and you just become terribly, terribly bloated. You know, the whole thing was like something out of a play. She said at one point to somebody, you probably have a bed here where you put the Puerto Rican from the Bronx. And we all kind of looked at her and looked around the emergency room and we're like, you're right. As soon as the doctors knew what she had, they were like, forget about it because we're going to treat you, we're going to waste our time because you're going to keep drinking. It took some time for her to really convince them and our time to convince them that she truly stopped and that they should try, just try to make her healthy again.
I think one of the things what was interesting about your piece, Rose, is the fact that Elaine's family, that they didn't know.
I think that they didn't know because, like a lot of families, the behavior around drinking was normal to them. Everyone had drank at some point in that family. And really, you know, the ones that didn't drink had kind of adopted another religion, adopted another habit that was more healthy as their way of stealing themselves from the desire to be self-destructive. They didn't look at somebody who'd have five or six drinks every other night as something so extraordinary until after they got sick.
I mean, Rose, now that we've lost Elaine, I look around at the culture of drinking in our country. How do we really wrap our heads around the fact that this is a drug that is legal, but it takes so many more lives than the illegal drugs?
Well, particularly it takes Latino lives. And I think it's because liquor, when combined with other factors, can be deadly. And I think one big factor is stress. stress and depression. And there's a lot of things that lead to stress that are overrepresented in our community. Lack of employment, lack of opportunity, lack of training, lack of education, high pregnancy rates, high drug abuse rates. People walk around with all these burdens. And drinking, rather than become like an occasional celebratory kind of thing, becomes an escape. And the other thing is this like tradition that people binge drink in Latin America. They come here where people don't really binge drink as much. They drink more frequently. And so people start to adopt both things at the time. They're going through an assimilation process that adds stress to poverty, lack of education, etc. You know, I've talked to more than one person who's a sociologist who says that, you know, there's this sort of like two-headed monster when you talk about things like social ills with people. On the one hand, you want to be supportive. A guy gets drunk, you want to help him clean up, right? But one of the reasons people don't do that is because it's not cool.
Elaine Rivera's career was dedicated to telling untold stories. You know, how do we, in fact, celebrate Elaine when we lost Elaine way too early and by her own hand, essentially?
Yes, I think there's a couple of ways we do it. I think one is we do celebrate her journalism and her desire that young people be educated, that Latinos be educated. You know, and what I wanted to do with this article is that we begin to talk about the things that plague our communities. Elaine was a master at that. She had, you know, done this investigative project on Latina suicide because she thought, like, wow, this is something we should be talking about. You know, Latina pregnancy, how can it be, she'd say with outrage, that half of our young women are getting pregnant before they're in their 20s. That's wrong. That holds us back. And I think it's the same thing with drinking. I would have loved to have seen Elaine do ongoing coverage, in-depth coverage, of how our community is held back by drinking. She can't do it. Why not us, you know?
That is a great way to celebrate Elaine. So in order to celebrate Elaine, we thank you very much, Rose, for coming and sharing your thoughts about Elaine Rivera, the great American journalist.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rose. Rose Arce is a former television producer for CNN, where I worked with her for 8 years. At the end of every edition of our program, we bring you some sabiduría, some words of wisdom. This next woman will go unnamed because of her alcoholism. But she's living proof that in spite of the difficulties Latinas and Latinos face, substance abuse, depression, thoughts of suicide, you may always have these problems, but they don't have to be the end. Words of wisdom now from a recovering Latina alcoholic.
I had a happy childhood in the South Bronx in the 1950s. My Latino parents liked to host parties, and I would take sips from their drinks. As a teenager, I went to neighborhood parties with girlfriends, but I was the only one who drank too much and got sick. In my 20s, I drank socially, married my childhood sweetheart, and we had 2 children. By my 30s, I had divorced my cheating husband and become a single mom. I was filled with fear and resentment and found comfort in dance clubs. I began to drink with abandon. Soon, my alcoholism progressed, and I lost all control. I lost weekends to hangovers. I lost quality time with my children. I lost my memory to blackouts. But I always had a job. I thought I was okay as a functioning alcoholic. My mother helped me with the kids, but when she died suddenly, I was beyond devastation. And I vowed to stop drinking. But I couldn't stop. Years went by, and one drink always led to another and another. I considered suicide as a way out. It seemed easier to die than to go on living. I had reached a turning point. I shared my problem with a friend who I admired for her calm and positive attitude. She confided that Alcoholics Anonymous had restored her to sanity, and she suggested I attend a few meetings. She said, "The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking." Desperate for help, I went to my first AA meeting, where they said that by following 12 simple steps, With the guidance of an experienced AA sponsor, I could stop drinking alcohol and lead a reasonably happy life, one day at a time. I was willing to go to any lengths to stop the pain, so I attended more meetings, found a sponsor, and began to take action. In step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, and our lives had become unmanageable. I learned it's a we program. We help one another get sober and stay sober. In step two, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. It's a spiritual program, not a religious one. My sponsor urged me to find a personal God who loved and protected me unconditionally. In step three, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him or her. I decided to surrender my belief that I could control people, places, and things. Instead, I accepted the possibility that a higher power would care for me. I haven't had a drink in more than 12 years. I stay sober one day at a time, and I'm reasonably happy, with God in one hand and AA in the other. Recovering alcoholics in AA have one primary purpose: to carry the message to suffering alcoholics. To learn more about AA, a worldwide organization, sign on to aa.org for information in Spanish or English. I promise you, if I can do it, you can too. It works if you work it.
And we want to say a very special thank you to our anonymous contributor for speaking out and for the hope. Gracias. Y queridos y queridas, that's it for this week as we push past the blues. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Katie Davis, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Special thanks this week to Luis Perez from Vocalo. Our interns are Julia Alsop, Sarah Barrett, Sara Rocha, Roxanne Scott, and Brenda Rodriguez, who leaves us this week to go back to the University of Idaho in Moscow, Idaho. Gracias, Brenda. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And meanwhile, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and our new Latino USA Instagram, at Latino USA, all one word. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Funding for Latino USA's coverage of a culture of health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, at 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Pew Charitable Trust, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR.